Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, my name is Rachel Stewart. I'm a host for the New Book Network for the channel Sex, Sex Work and Sexualities. And today I have the pleasure of speaking to Dr. Raven Bowen about her book, Work, Money and Duality. Raven, it's awesome to have you here. So can you tell us who you are, Raven? What is your academic background and what are you currently doing?
Sure. So I've been around for the block for a while, probably close to three decades, working on sex worker rights stuff, community development in Canada and in the UK. I've done a BA in sociology, an MA in criminology at Simon Fraser University, and then I came to the UK to do a PhD at Durham that I ended up finishing at York in sociology. And right now I am the CEO of National Ugly Mugs, which is a UK-wide charity that provides support to people in adult industries who experience harm. And we run a national reporting and alerting mechanism and checker tools and those kinds of things to make sure that those populations are safe.
Okay. And for the listeners, we'll pop in a link to National Ugly Mugs in the blurb that accompanies this. So, I've just finished reading your book. It was awesome. I really enjoyed it. A very important book. The introduction is really important because you tell us at length about what this book is not. Can you tell the listeners what the book isn't?
Yeah. And that was really important to open it that way because, you know, we see sometimes when research and other media and other, you know, entities draw attention to populations within sex industries, sometimes that has really dangerous effects and negative effects on those populations. So I wanted to make sure that by talking about people who live dual lives and inserting their experiences into our discourse, that it's not an opportunity for a witch hunt. It's not an opportunity to, you know, look for individuals who you might think are doing something else on the side and try to investigate their lives. It's not a population that I'm putting forward in the ways that I am in order to be targets of some gaze that, you know, will affect their life chances and their abilities to survive.
Okay. So we've explored what the book isn't. What is the book? What is the book doing?
Sure. It's doing multiple things, which is why it was such a challenge to write. The book is expanding how people who are outside of industries may think of the sex industry and who trades sex. So it sort of like expands who people think sex workers are. It speaks back into some of the research that defines sex work involvement and exiting as binary. It talks about issues that of the practicality of living a dual life, the ins and outs of that, why people do it, and links that back in with the larger structure within our precarious labor market and precarity within sex industries as well. And it really, it is that sort of the mirror of telling the story of this group of workers for us to look at our what kind of capitalist society we've co-constructed, what kind of capitalism we're practicing such that individuals like these are among the most hidden populations of sex workers.
Okay. So again, I'm sort of back to the introduction, because I spent ages going over the introduction because I kept kind of grazing over it. It was really interesting to read. So your book positions itself as opposed to radical, carceral and prohibitionist perspectives on sex workers. On sex work, sorry. What does that mean? I mean, I know what that means, but for the listeners, what does that mean?
Yeah, sure. It is about people who believe that sex industry is harmful for everyone all the time. And they, you know, that's an inaccurate depiction of what's going on here. Like as in any other form of work, sex workers, people experience exploitation, people move in and out, there's harms that happen. So that's no different than in industries. But approaches that, you know, seem to present sex workers as a population in need of rescue. For this population in particular, they sort of stand in the face of that, because what are they going to be rescued to? What employment are they going to be rescued to? Because they're already in square jobs. Like they're already working across sectors in square jobs. So they can't be rescued, right? And, you know, even for the populations who I think some feminists focus on rescuing, we have no investment in how that rescue is going to happen. We haven't even asked people if they want to, you know, to leave and what that looks like, or if they want to blend sex work with spirit. We haven't asked the questions of the population. And I think that a lot of responses to sex working and sex industries are always the enforcement ones, are always, you know, more police, more, you know, algorithms, more data scraping, more this, more that. And it's like that, if we're about increasing safety and workers' rights across sectors, then criminalizing and painting everyone as a victim is not a way to achieve that.
No, I totally agree with that, and I totally get that, because there's a perception that somehow if you're engaged in sex work, that you're apart from the mainstream. And what this book is highlighting, what became really apparent through the book, is that actually you're talking about sex workers, and I would argue the majority of sex workers, who are actually engaged in mainstream like employment, but who, you know, if we listen to sort of radical feminism, would say are so estranged from mainstream living that they need to be rescued and put back into the mainstream. But actually this book said, actually no, they are already mainstream.
They're already
mainstream
here.
Not working.
I heard an academic talking about, you know, the Bristol's initiative to potentially shut down the sexual entertainment venues. And the individual said that we'll shut down the venues and open coffee shops and places where sex workers can work. And it was just like, those dancers probably already have jobs in coffee shops and other places, right? Like it just doesn't, you know, it doesn't. Yeah, we have to stop romanticizing what square work is for people. Yeah. Because, you know, as we hear in the literature and as we hear from sex workers, a lot of them move out of exploitive square jobs into sex industries. So, you know, we can't romanticize that as a solution or a destination. I think the focus needs to be on dealing with people who are experiencing poverty and may go through those situations where they're unable to refuse work, which happens across the industry. And that's what we tend to term survival sex. And then for people who want to professionalize their sex work, we have to support them in regulating their own industry. Simple, you know, that'll unemploy probably a lot of the public sector, but it's, you know, if we're about safety in the industry, let's not create these make work projects and criminalize legal work. Let's make sure that workers are safe and they have options to choose the amount of sex work involvement that they're comfortable with, from 0 to 100%, right?
Yeah. And I mean, it's automatically becomes like an implicit critique of that kind of whole rescue industry debate, you know. I've sex worked in the past. I don't need to be rescued. You know, I need to change to the neoliberal capitalist system. You know, I don't need to be rescued.
Yeah, people want to be rescued from their square jobs where they're making, you know, low pay and the time investment versus that money time ratio, like it's not making sense. They're putting so much time and energy into their jobs, and they're, you know, at the end of the week they make 200 quid, which, you know, it's like, how is that a quality, dignified work experience.
Exactly. I was far more exploited in the university system as a postgrad than I've ever been in selling sex.
You know, sell that's sex. A pyramid scheme. Or yeah, that's definitely a multi-level marketing. No, that's it's very, I guess scholarship is so much built on the free labor of novices and neophytes and, you know, but lots of industries are that way. So we shouldn't be surprised that sex industries mirror the kinds of exploitations and opportunities that exist in mainstream society.
Yeah, you got to keep your street smarts wherever you are. You got to be street smart. You got to be street smart if you're hustling. You definitely have to be street smart when you're in a university setting. Just telling you. But anyway, tell us about duality in the context of this book.
Sure. So duality is, a term that I've applied to this kind of, to people who blend sex work and square jobs, because there wasn't language around it really. Like sex workers would say about they have their side hustle or they have their square job on the side or whatever, but there wasn't really a term that was not negatively connotated that talked about, you know, blending work arrangements. And so duality exists beyond how I've theorized it. It's existed for generations. And there are scholars who have touched on it but haven't done a really deep dive into the practices of people who engage in sex work and in duality. So that's what I wanted to do, is one, investigate this as a phenomenon, not as a new novel one, because, you know, this has been something that workers have done around the world, probably for time immemorial, but investigate it in the ways that sex workers in the UK are practicing it and how they're, you know, managing the information, the audiences, how they're able to keep their work, some of their work secret from different populations, and what the costs of that are and what they have to say about work in general and about the challenges in the kind of marketplaces that we've created, because the people in this sample are individuals who, you know, they're skilled, they're educated, they would normally have a lot of choice in terms of the work they would do. The majority of the population are white, majority are female, and they find themselves with really fragmented work opportunities. And so they had to fill the gaps by engaging in sex work and supplementing income that way in order for them to have any sense of stability and any opportunity to build a life. Because this is beyond subsistence, right? It's beyond eking out one bread and butter. It's, you know, some people aspire to more than that in their lives, and they thought that getting an education and getting into the mainstream society would afford that, but it doesn't. We've made it so.
Yeah. I mean, and also as well, this book really, for me, it kind of built on some existing literature, one of which was really obvious. So like, you know, sort of Bernstein, Intimately Yours, you know, sort of like, you know, white sort of middle class women in the American West Coast who couldn't actually, you know, get the stuff that they needed, you know, with their qualifications. So professionalized an area of sex work. But it also made me think of a sociologist from the 1970s. Who talks about the economics of makeshift, and that sex work has been a sort of like a go-to for marginal, well, not even marginalized women, but women experiencing precarity for generations.
Yes, absolutely.
One of the toolbox. And actually what we're experiencing here is a kind of, you know, that sort of return to business as usual. Like, so the welfare state, that kind of sort of Fordist Keynesian thing, was the exception. And now we go back to business as usual, when actually you need to have like all these different sort of things ticking over just to be able to, like, you know, to be able to get to where you're going. And this book, I believe, really feeds into that. It kind of like says, you know what, we're going back to what we always have been, which is people do different things.
Yeah. And that is like the dual labor market as well. Yeah. Like that idea that, you know, some populations had open-ended contracts and severance pay and, you know, family wages, and they could, you know, support their families, have a bank account and take the kids on holidays all at the same time. And then there were these populations in other areas of the dual of the labor market that always had to blend multiple informal maybe sometimes criminal work, you know, like I think of people even in my own family who work their mainstream job, go home, eat dinner, and then go back out to their evening part-time shift. My brother does that. Like, you know, my younger brother, he does that. I think he has three jobs right now because he's, you know, buying a house in Toronto. So that's what he's doing. And so there's, I think there's lots of population who side hustling is not new to. And side hustling includes legal work, such as sex industry work for some populations.
And I mean, I think that's really important to think about as well. Like for some populations, and I think it's Fan Tony talks about this, and she talks about, you know, precarity has been a, you know, has been standard for people forever. But when it starts to affect sort of like white middle class men, all of a sudden it becomes an issue and becomes talked about. But there's more than that, isn't it? Like my experience, you know, I come from a sort of like a traveler background, and you know, I've talked about that quite a lot. But we have a job. Because it distracts, the job is a shield.
Oh, yeah.
The job is sort of like is an explanation of what it is that you're doing. You've never earned enough money to live on that job, but it's something you can hold up to kind of keep, you know, prying eyes away.
The off-street workers who I've known over the years, that's it, and especially folks who are parents, they would always keep a square job. You need the paper trail, you need access to, you know, assistance, you need access to a bank card, you need to be able to make a good account of yourself, but they're working in jobs that there's no way they could support a family if that's all they did.
No,
absolutely not.
No, you've got, you know, sort of you've got to have sort of like, you've got, you know, it, you need the job to kind of make sure that you can actually be mainstream. So you need to take on this like poorly paid job to distract you from the highly paid job that you're doing in order to sort of make sure that, you know, you can buy your house, you can do what it is that you want to do.
Yeah. And the great thing with duality is that it doesn't force people to over rely on one job or the other.
Yeah.
So that, you know, they can always back away, take less shifts or take more shifts or whatever it means for them. That's why I use that embedded eternity symbol about that equilibrium. It is that balance, and it is flowing between, you know, practices of, you know, maybe you're doing a bit more square work and a little bit of sex work on the side, or maybe sometimes it's more equal time, or maybe you're doing more sex work than square work at times, but it, you know, it flows. Like it's definitely not a static thing. You know, the great thing about these folks, one, they're skilled, entrepreneurial, and they're go-getters. So if there's opportunities for work, they'll go after those opportunities for work. And so it's sort of, they're precarious because sex work is stigmatized. Right. Yeah. And so for them, it's, they would absolutely lose everything. They would lose standing in both realms. They could lose both jobs. They'd lose their future. They could lose family, personal relationships, and all of that. So that's what makes it precarious. But these folks are, you know, in a good economy, they're doing pretty well. So they're able to, you know, draw on sex industry work and square work for the emergencies that come up for them. They're able to save money to get on the property ladder. And then they're able to do more long-term, you know, lifestyle, social advancement, class advancement, social mobility stuff with doing sex industry work or square work on the side.
And you know what? I'm going to give another shout out to Belosa. Like Brooke Belosa, if you're listening to this, I demand coffee from you because I've mentioned you so much recently. But she describes something really interesting. She calls it hallmyopia. She says it's an affliction that only affects like feminist movements in its day, that somehow like sex work is placed outside the capitalist system. Like somehow sex workers do not have to adhere to the same sort of like, you know, game plan that everyone
rules
else.
And I think Judy Walkowitz talks about that. And I believe it's, oh God, she's going to probably have to kill me for this, but it is the outcasting. There's a book about the outcasting of sex workers from the working class.
I butchered
that completely.
It's the prostitution in Victorian Britain, when they're basically these sort of working class women that were quite often quite significant in their communities ostracized from their communities.
Absolutely. And the thing too is that, you know, these folks contribute to homes and economies, and, you know, they invest in their families and loved ones so that, you know, they accumulate wealth so that can be carried on. There's one person in the book, her name's Joy, and she had to make, I think it was 20,000 pounds in 9 weeks or something like that. So she hustled in her mainstream job and in sex industry to get that money for her child's tuition so that her child could go through school and leave without debt. She ended, you know, this sort of poverty or debt bondage in her family for a generation. Can you imagine leaving the PhD, leaving school without debt? Like, I don't know what that would be like myself. But she wanted to make sure that her child wouldn't be saddled with the burden of debt slavery on top of wage slavery, because any sort of job that individuals get right out of school, you know, they're not making great money.
And I think that's another important thing about the debates that this book provokes, because we tend to focus debates around sex work starting in the 1860s. Like, I don't know how many literature reviews I've read that start with the Contagious Diseases Act. Like, sex work wasn't going on before that. Actually, sex work was going on before industrialization, people.
Yeah.
And there's actually
part of industrialization.
And actually, you know, there are parts of London like that were built by sex working women. There's a terrace in Haverstock Hill in Northwest London, extremely expensive like properties now. It was built by a sex worker. Yeah. And you know, it's like when you look at the history of like sort of areas, like if you live in London, like Maid of Fell was where mistresses of rich men in St. John's Wood would live. Yeah. This is a thing. This has happened in the past. But what's happened is we've had this kind of like this kind of just this crushing of the narrative. You know, since 18.
Yeah, sex workers are part of like nation building. They're part of, you know, like, you know, when you think about when Europeans came, because I was born in the UK, but I grew up in Canada. So a lot of my politicization and experience of the UK comes from living in Canada and seeing what's happened there. And where we look at, you know, in Vancouver in particular, Gassy Jacks and all of these like, you know, pubs and brothels and, you know, supper clubs where, who do you think worked like in these places? Or what's her name? There's a
show coming
pausing to because Barbara Brentz wrote co-wrote a book, State of Sex. And there they talk about, you know, the surface jobs in the mines and then how women were working there, but they were also working in brothels. And they're like, it is being enterprising, being resourceful, and getting the resources that you need to support your family in whatever context is being presented to you, right? Yeah. And so sex workers today living in duality is no different than sex workers generations ago who were doing multiple things, right?
Yeah. Exactly. So it's almost like kind of like, let's step aside from this, you know, this feminist debate. So tell us about the theoretical approach that this study took.
Yeah, that was this interpretive phenomenological analysis, which is really fancy, but it is this phenomenology. It's like I'm looking at duality as this is a social phenomenon. And it's both a methodological approach and a theoretical approach. So it is that idea that you ask these open-ended questions, you do the prompts as we normally would do, but you support the contributor or the participant in interpreting their own behavior. So it's not, they're not just telling you what happened to them or why they're doing this or whatever, but it is that they're reflecting on how that behavior affects or is affected by the context,
okay.
Right? And then in the analysis bit, there were times I was warned by my committee to try not to do this in places where it didn't fit, but because I didn't want to share the tips and strategies of people living dual lives, but I wanted to share their insights. In the analysis for IPA, I pulled out the activities from the insights so that there were times in my coding I could look for their reflection of keeping secrets and not, you know, necessarily all the strategies around managing information. So I share some of it, but without revealing the strategies that keep people safe, because that is one thing that as researchers and others who share stories and report on sex industries, we have to really be careful about what the impacts of what we share is going to have on the populations. And because people people just trusted me in ways that, you know, I've been doing all kinds of different research studies over the years. And this is a population that you're not going to just find, right? Like, you can find them, but they're hiding from you, right? So it's not like, you know, they're an easily accessible population, and they have so much at stake to speak about their experiences. So I just felt I had to be so careful with what they said and share it in ways that they can't be invisibilized, but also respect the ways that they don't want to be seen.
Yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
But also as well, like in a sort of environment where, you know, sort of like criminalization of sex work means that sex workers cannot come together and work together, you know, to share the information that people give you in a way that protects the sharer, but also gives information, useful information, to the other members of that community.
Exactly.
Really, really important, you know.
Yeah. Really. And this book was primarily written for sex workers. Like, there are lots of audiences that it would land, but just it's an interpretation of the experiences that people shared, and people may, sex workers may take this and, you know, deconstruct it. They may challenge some of it. They may want to, you know, explore other parts of it, but it is about just, this is another way that we can argue for rights, for recognition, for safety, for ending criminalization that is based on only sex workers that we can see, that all of these policies and practices to police and monitor and eliminate sex industries will have huge, huge ripple effects on people. And yeah, it's just, I'm hoping that I introduce, through the insights of these contributors, new ways for us to argue for fairness, for equity, and for sex worker in civil participation in policymaking and lawmaking and occupational health and safety standards and all of those things. Because it's really difficult for people who, you know, halfway through, part of them has access to resources and police protection and bank accounts and all this stuff, and the other half of them does not, like, depending on which persona they're operating within. And it's just they embody the conflict and those antagonisms, and they find ways to reconcile those things. But it's a really challenging way to work.
Yeah.
And they make no qualms about that. Like, it's a very challenging thing to maintain.
Yeah. You use a phrase that I've come across before, but was not entirely sure I knew what it meant until I read this book, right? And I want you to explain it for the listeners. It's dolly mop. How does this book explore that? Because I think it's quite important, you know, it's quite contextual to what you've just been saying.
Yeah, this is the way. Okay, so this is something that Kate Lister talks about, as well as Rubinald, who wrote The Five, talks about this, the fact that sex workers who were with sailors or sex workers who are doing other work on the side, certain populations, like servants and dressmakers, and certain populations were always seen to be available for sex, or may always, or were engaging in sex industries in order to supplement their incomes from, like, the sewing trades and from trades that were underpaid. So I share the historical context of duality just to show that it did exist. There were it existed for people who were seeing soldiers and who were seen as informal prostitutes because they were dating soldiers and they were in that vicinity. And it is this way that we're that, you know, women were, yeah, the way that, sorry, I'm losing it a little
no,
bit.
No, I get it.
Edit that out.
I think what you're saying and why I picked up the point because it resonated with something else that I'd read is that sort of like women experiencing precarity, and precarity is not a new thing. Okay, so women experiencing precarity have always been marginalized because of their poverty.
Yeah.
But then that poverty that causes the precarity that is then used to demonize them. And the example I knew and why I sort of like the connected with me with this is it's the word spinster. I don't know if anyone knows this, but spinster.
I know that one.
Spinster used to be synonymous with the word like prostitute, because if you were you know engaged in, you know, if you're a spinster, literally someone who span, yeah, that's precarious and seasonal work. So in between time, it was assumed that you would be, you know, engaging in sexual commerce and or stealing. So it was a generally, you know, derogatory term for single poor women or marginalized women. And I think that's important, isn't it? It's because women have been marginalized for their poverty. Yeah.
And blamed for it.
And blamed
in these ways.
For it.
Yeah.
And then when they try to tackle their poverty with whatever economic makeshift is available to them, they are condemned again.
Again.
You know,
yeah, so it's this double condemnation of, but what's really sickening about it is that we gendered the workplaces in ways that women wouldn't have full-time well-paid jobs, right? Like we've created these sort of oppressions and these different ways of valuing people's work and labor and bodies in ways that certain bodies weren't valuable and certain ones are, right? And so it is that it's like they're damned if they do, they're damned if they don't, they're damned if they innovate, they're damned if they don't innovate. Like either like there's no way out.
Yeah, exactly. And it takes it back to that discussion about why this book isn't sort of carceral, is opposed to radical and carceral and prohibitionist perspectives, because actually this conversation that we've been having about since the 1860s, where, you know, where women who were experiencing poverty try to address their poverty, then instead of the poverty being an issue, what became the issue? And, you know, feminists, they need to take the responsibility for this. Early feminist campaigners, instead of addressing the underlying social issues that quite often they were benefiting from, would address sex work rather than poverty.
Yeah. Well, and it's easier, and it's such a deflection on how we're all complicit in creating those labor markets and those environments that allow some to thrive and some to suffer, right?
Exactly.
And yeah, it's just a way of, even now when you hear prohibitionist feminists talking about ending the sex industry, ending demand, it's like, can we deal with poverty first? Can we make sure that, you know, people who are in sex industries who really don't want to be but are there because it's a source of income, can we deal with that first and then deal with labor rights? Like, why is it the first thing that we have to do is use enforcement tactics to eliminate industries, which eliminate also sex workers in various ways? Sex workers are being eradicated and harmed in ways that we see, in ways that we don't see. So I you know, it is that same, it's easier to target a population of people, right? So if the economy is going bad, it's either immigrants or people of color or what, like, it's, you know, there's always somebody to blame. And I think that those strategies are, I don't think any of it's an accident.
No, I don't think so either. I don't think so. And especially when there's so much money to be made out of rescue. So tell us about the sex industry work and square work continuum that the book discusses.
Yeah, sure. So that was my way of mapping the practices. So when I was interviewing people, I asked them about how much work versus how much money they make versus their goals and intentions. So the continuum maps sex workers who are dabbling and supplementing the income in sex industries just a little bit, or in square work just a little bit, or sexiting so that they have goals to exit, but they're blending sex work and square work to fund those transitions. And for people who are involved in duality in more temporary ways, where they're just dealing with some emergencies or some projects, and then for people who are doing it as part of social mobility. So it was like, I started mapping it, but then realized how fluid and messy it all is. And the continuum in the book isn't even the final one, right? Like, I think I added another little segment there. So that's the thing about, I've just created a framework for us to explore duality, not as like an identity. Like, you know how people think survival sex workers are a population, but it's actually a condition. It's not a population. This kind of thing, it's that, you know, these are practices at the intersection of sex work and square work. People may move about, may shift, may do a little more of this, a little less that, whatever, but there's still intention around it. There's still goals. Like, people who are supplement or dabbling are exploring a new workforce or a new workplace or a new industry, but, you know, there's intention behind it. So it's kind of separate than what Scambler 1999 wrote about in terms of bohemians, or, you know, people who are in it to just explore sexuality, because there are tons of people who do industry work to explore their sexuality. But specifically duality, I was focusing on people who had the underlying intention of making money. Yeah. And they were gainfully employed in both sex industries and square work. But then it's not to say they weren't also doing other things, like in school, on benefits. Like, there were all kinds of things that people were doing in addition to this. But yeah, it was just, it's just a framework to sort of lay it out and see how we as researchers, how experiential folks can kind of work with it. And if they like it, keep it. If they don't, then, you know, maybe there's a new and better way of discussing that, all of those practices.
I like as well the way that it sort of like brings into discussion, because this is like one of my biggest angst around people, you know, who write about sex work, who's not engaged in sex work. It's almost like, it's almost like this sort of perception that on some level that sex work is something, is generally anything other than survival. I had a journalist contact me a few weeks ago who wanted to talk about survival sex work. And I'm like, what do you mean by survival sex work? He's like, you know, people that need the money to survive.
Everybody needs money.
Yeah. So what are you, a survival journalist? Are you being paid, or are you doing this stuff? Yeah, you're doing this in a journal. And it's the same. Like, my experience is like, yeah, I got to explore my sexuality because I didn't want to explore my poverty.
Yeah. Poverty is deadly. Like, you know, some people might want to, you know, guard against that as much as they can, but we all do. And it is that, it's to varying degrees, because you could be a well-paid middle-class or higher-end industry worker, but in that moment, you need to break even. And entrepreneurs understand this. Until you break even, you're survival. Sorry. But until you have your living expenses paid, your insurance, whatever it is in your life, or for people who, hey, they need their fix, because we're all functioning alcoholics and drug addicts around here anyway. So until you get all of the, you know, your medicines, whatever you do in your life, all your priorities, until you get all your priorities funded, you're a survival worker.
Yeah.
So a freelance journalist should understand that better than anyone, I would think. But it is that there are some populations who aren't able to ever like refuse clients, and aren't able to ever exercise choice around who they see and what they do and how they do sex work and how they do square jobs. Some populations they're always in a perpetual state because of, you know, cycles of poverty and criminalization and stigma and all those things. But, you know, the idea of engaging in duality is to have a bit more power and more control. And, you know, workers in the book talk about being more selective about the jobs that they take and the work that they take, because they have other sources of income. Yep. And that is the ideal way to engage, not only in sex work, but to engage in work.
Yeah.
Is to not have some, you're not to be a debt slave or a wage slave to one entity, right?
Yeah,
or to one source of income.
Exactly. So can you tell us how the book deals with role transition?
Yeah, that is something else, isn't it? it is, because, you know, all of us are moving in and out of roles, and that, you know, based on what we're doing and work and home, and we have these really integrated and segregated skills, and we're presenting in different ways depending on what we're doing. So from student to mom or whatever, it's all different. So sex work is, sex workers, people who do soul sex work also do this, right? They're, you know, and sometimes they have to cut off the ways that they know things, their knowledge, their skills, they have to cut off, they have to create separations. Mm-hmm. And for people who live dual lives specifically, in order to sustain duality, you have to create the separation between your square job and your sex industry job, even if there's a more permeable boundary between your sex work and your personal life, for example. So some people in this, there's actually one individual in the sample who I believe, there's only one, who her square employer knew about her sex work job. But most of the time, those are populations and audiences that you have to keep separate. So as you're moving in and out of roles, people have rituals where that they engage in to move in and out and to perform the roles in the ways that are expected so that they're not giving off or giving away any information that could out them.
Yeah.
The important thing here is it's not just that sex people are hiding sex work. It's like people are hiding square work from sex industry folks too. And people are hiding, you know, information about both kinds of work from their personal networks. And like there's all of this information management and selective disclosure that's happening because, you know, people want to have like some semblance of sanity and some peace of mind, because you can't have mixed audiences all the time because you can't control who knows what about you. And that's like a central important piece for people.
And it's quite an important debate to talk about, like hiding the details of your straight life, your square life, from the people you know from sex working. There's a massive amount of snobbery involved in sex work, isn't it? It was like supermodels that I don't get out of bed for less than £10,000, you know? It's that deal, isn't it? It's like, you know, and I don't think that we talk about this enough, is that actually the relatively, you know, the relatively high wages that you can earn with sex work, and I'm not saying it's easy, but it can be quick, that in itself presents problems. You know, why would you go and work for a week when you could do, you know, give someone a blowjob and, you know, that's a week done. You know, why would you do that?
Yeah, and the ways that people contain their sex work and square work or create distance, like touring, as you know, is really popular. And so some folks would intensely work for a weekend every 6 months or something like that, make the revenue, go back to their square jobs or whatever. So it is that, you know, for them, they see the insanity of, you know, the time is the most precious thing we have.
Yeah.
That's it for most of us. We don't have assets. We don't have anything. So if you're giving away 40 hours to an employer to benefit them mostly, because, you know, it's for them, it's for capitalists, it's mostly about profit and underpaying workers and getting as much profit as they can. So why give 40 hours to that when you can invest in yourself or invest in a business venture or invest in entrepreneurialism within sex industries and make 10 times what you would make giving your labor away, right? So these folks make that rationale, and it's really difficult for them sometimes to recognize, hey, I work for a month and I make what I could make in 2 or 3 days in sex industries. And that's not a modern thing. That's something that sex workers and scholars have been pointing out for generations, 18th century, 19th century. And it's because sex working for those populations is rational. Duality is a rational response to the conditions that we've created in the labor market. And, you know, there are people in the book who want to work one job. And I came at duality with the assumption that people want non-dualism. Like I came to it with the assumption that people don't want to manage all these people and hide and this phone for this and that phone for that. And oh my God, you know, like that's chaos. And that takes a lot of work to do. Some people are really good at it because they're just, that's their way of being in the world. They're just, that's what they do. They manage different segregated audiences and information. That's cool. But, you know, some people just want one good paying job. Like they just want one job. And based on...
What is that?
Yeah, and it is an unreasonable request these days. You know, it seems like we've got all these delivery drivers and all the like. We're we have an economy where we, as consumers, we're choosing to have accounts and invest in companies that offer these fragmented, short-term, precarious jobs. And so, you know, we have populations of people who having one job, if they, it depends on their goals. Like if you ever want to buy a house, having one job is probably not going to do it. Right? Like, you know, and one of the participants, the contributors said that, like, watched a block of flats go up, then it went on for sale, and then they're priced out of the market. The locals are completely priced out of the market. And so buying a house for that person without duality, impossible.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's interesting you mentioned phones then, because you talk about phones in the book. You, and I quote, iPhones are a killer, right? Can you tell us about this?
Okay, that was Rachel that said that, not Raven. Someone's going to get sued if you, no, but it is that thing about, there are, you know, there's software out there that wants to integrate everything, that wants to, you know, your browsing history, your contact list, your photos, like, you know, so if you don't do things to make sure that you're using different devices or you're avoiding certain software that has a tendency to, you know, want this one world and everybody knows everything and they're introducing your contacts to somebody else, you know, you have to really, we have so little control of our social media accounts. So you have to be very, very careful about what persona you're using on what device, what phone number you're using on what device, because one phone number can link to pictures and all kinds of stuff and link your contacts in ways that are unsafe for you. And yeah. I just think that this is an argument that, you know, ICT folks have been talking about for many years. It is that, you know, we need to have more control outside of people who live dual lives. We just need to have more control over who sees our information and how our networks are linked. But, yeah. You know, it just seems that networking is the big thing these days, but it's like not everybody wants to be part of the matrix. Sometimes we want to be outside of the web for good reason, outside of the net for good reasons. And so these folks, they've developed strategies around that, but even still, like, you know, you can have a VPN on your browser, but that doesn't prevent information about you and your browsing becoming known, right? Yeah. Like, you know, there's so many things that people have to decide what they're hiding from whom and how these tools are able, and using separate devices and things, are able to support that, but they're not going to be able to hide who their duality or their digital footprint from everyone.
Yeah. Right. But I mean, you know, for new dualists, yeah, as soon as you
baby dualists,
as soon as you can, get yourself down to the local hock shop and buy yourself a second handset. Okay, just do that. You will save yourself a lot of aggravation. Your sexy self will not start to appear on other people's,
like, on other people's
people you should know.
Yeah, and it's interesting because Swarm has a dial tone project for sex workers to provide that second phone, not only for, you know, not necessarily for managing duality, but for managing just separating church and state, right? That, you know, you have your work phone and you have your phone, your personal phone, and just creating that separation because it's healthy. Like, we need digital detoxes. Like, we need to be able to step away from things. And as industry folks, like, I remember talking to a webcammer who every time there would be a notification ding, she would like have a panic attack. Like, it's just, you know, she would have a panic attack hearing like, you know, all the conversations and the notifications. At times it's just enough. And so
it's quite
to have that work, like, yeah, it is. And then you're always at work, which is part of the challenge with living a dual life too, is that sometimes for some of these folks, work really never ended. They would bounce between different jobs, doing both jobs concurrently sometimes, when, especially for folks who are working at home. You know, there's one woman who said that she works in her pants, and I had to, like, of course you do, like, you know.
So tell us about how the book explores hierarchies and what it meant to the people you were researching.
Yeah, this was something that the book was not intended to, or the research wasn't intended to explore at all. But it was something that came out because of the time frame of data collection, it was during the EU referendum, and there was a lot of sentiment around Britishness, nationalism, Europeans in, you know, the UK workforce, the impacts that people felt that was having. And so it was something that came through in some of the early interviews, and then I added it as a formal question to ask about impacts of Brexit, et cetera. But the population in the book are mostly white working class folks and white migrant workers to the UK. So the ways that they were discussing who was valued and who wasn't in the industry was based on Europeanness versus Britishness or UKness, or, you know, so that came out really, really strongly. And, you know, hierarchy is something that's been in the industry for years. Like we've all been talking about stratification in different ways and which populations are valued more than others. But it was important for me to really highlight the ways that Brexit and those sentiments about anti or Europhobia and anti-European sentiments affected how it restructured the sex industry so that, you know, the top of the hierarchy are white British. And if you were any deviation, including white migrants, then you were feeling the effects of not being seen as the most valuable population in industries. And just the interactions that people were having with their clients, of how the clients were proving up Britishness and how they were expected to prove up Britishness. And for white migrants in the sample, there's one in particular who just raged about this because, you know, she was told that she was the right kind of migrant and, mm-hmm. you know, those kinds of, you know, sentiments. And it's interesting to just show the hierarchy as it was manifest for these participants, but also the broader context. But I didn't do too much of that. I wanted to kind of stay grounded in how culture and how white Europeans are being constructed out of whiteness in the hierarchy and how important that is. It was just something that was undeniable and unavoidable in as a means of shaping, you know, who was seen as valuable and who wasn't. And, you know, and it shouldn't be a surprise that these things manifest within the sex industry, because it's doing this was a way of showing that sex workers are part of our society. Sex workers, there are some sex workers in the book who wanted Europeans out of the industry potentially because, you know, it might affect the pricing. Maybe the pricing will go up. And there are people, you know, who they're all across the political spectrum, and they're embedded and affected and part of shaping our society and our, you know, values. And so seeing the reflection of our societal values around race among a sample of white sex workers, I thought was very intriguing.
And I think that's an important discussion that we need to have as well, because, like, we can't dismantle the house using the master's tools. Yeah. So we're not going to affect change.
Dream Lord.
Thank you, Audrey. but we've got to be self-critical. Yeah, we've got to be self-critical, because when I was doing my research with people at webcams, their assumptions about Eastern European cameras was that they were all being horribly exploited in studios. Right. And this is said from people who've never been to Romania. So they don't actually realize that actually, you know, most people live in extended families. Really hard to webcam with your gran in the next room. Yeah. You need to go somewhere to do it. Doesn't necessarily mean you're being exploited. I'm not saying that exploitation doesn't happen, and any capitalist setup is going to happen. But, you know, there's this assumption that, you know, we can't other each other by assuming victimization of each other. But also as well, we can't buy into the hierarchy, like, you know, like the hierarchy that sort of positions like web cameras at the top and street workers at the bottom. Because actually, inadvertently then we reflect the aspirations of the oppressor. In a neoliberal society, of course webcams are going to be at the top of the tree, because you know what, every single transaction goes through the banking system. So good horse. Because you're paying man.
And we have to try, because there is a lot of lateral oppression that happens in sex industries and every other industry, and But we do have to try to stop reinforcing those values. But it doesn't stop and it doesn't start in the industry. It starts in society. Yeah. Because we value people based on a lot of things, including race, gender, all of that stuff. Like there are hierarchies within marketplaces, within workforces. And for us, we need to not deny that. And then it starts there, because then microcosms like sex industries and other industries, they do mirror, reflect back, recreate and shoot back at us what we produced here. So, you know, valuing the bodies that are valued in sex industries are the same ones that are valued in movies and the same ones that are valued in magazines and the same, you know, the same people who, you know, would probably receive protection in terms of like the ideal victim. Like they're the same populations, and the people who are doing quite well in mainstream societies are the same people who are doing well in sex industries. Like it's, you know, it's kind of like the same thing. So I think that we have to, the hierarchy reflects back our social, economic and political hierarchies that exist in mainstream societies. And we have to be honest about that and dismantle that using whatever tools, but hopefully from the inside out.
So I mean, only a few more questions left. So the violence of exclusion, tell me about that.
Yeah. And I think we kind of started talking about that, where it is that, you know, sex working populations are not necessarily included in, you know, policy initiatives or strategies that are supposed to improve safety, improve rights for populations. The tendency is to talk about sex workers and not with them. And we see that for generations and generations. And many of us have been working on sex worker inclusion for generations as well. And so it's really important that we hear from diverse populations of sex workers when we're crafting anything. And we, the royal we, as in policymakers and people with power to craft things, because we're going to create unintended consequences. We're going to miss people that should be at the table, you know, and that we're going to impact populations that will never see, know, or understand until it's too late. And so part of that is just an ethical practice of inclusion, because, you know, there has been a lot of exclusion of most relevant populations, but usually in the modern day, we challenge when people are excluded. Like we challenge if there's a charity that's run for people of color where there's no people of color in it. Like we challenge that kind of thing. So we need to also challenge that when it comes to sex work issues, when it comes to understanding the phenomenon, when it comes to understanding harm and violence as defined by the population, because we shouldn't be out on a crusade to eliminate violence within industries as we interpret it. We should be out to remedy it and find remedy for the ways that sex workers interpret and label and define violence. Otherwise, we're perpetuating harms against them. Yeah. So, you know, I think that, like we have to do that in every way possible. And for me, because I'm in the position of power as I am in the organization that I run, I have to make sure that sex workers are, active and former sex workers are on staff, are in operations. That those are the people you see. Those are the people who are doing research into their communities. Those are the people who are invested in to, you know, partner to lead the agenda around safety and rights, because this is their issue. For active sex workers, this issue is not belong to researchers or policymakers or nobody else. This is sex workers' fight. And so, you know, either support, come when you're called on, or get out of the way.
Yeah.
Because lives are at stake here for people. So for me, this exclusion, it reminds me of, you know, like just ways that we dehumanize and silence populations that we choose not to bother to hear from, that are not worthy of having a seat at the table. And it's like, you know, in the most part, sex workers built the damn table. Like, so what are you talking about? Of course they should be there. And so this book is drawing it back. Like it's focusing on the population, but really I'm talking about the rest of us.
Yeah.
And so making sure that, you know, we're very inclusive and very clear about why we're implementing the strategies that we do and how that is supposed to have a material or a benefit to sex workers in terms of their priorities. And anyone who can't explain that, whether you're a researcher or a practitioner or a policymaker or a politician, if you can't explain how sex workers benefit from what you're doing, then, you know, you got to kind of stop and I think take a breath and speak to the community and realize and make sure that you're working in their interests. Otherwise, go work on something else.
Yeah. And it's funny because that's raised throughout the book, but also it's sort of like harkens back to Revolting Prostitutes by Smith and Mack. And they talk about, you know, like activists who take on the voice of sex workers because they've become so involved with activism. You know, before this meeting with you today, I've just been to a meeting, 17 people about sex workers. The only sex worker who's there was me. I'm not a current sex worker and I'm not there as a sex worker. I'm there as a researcher. So if I didn't happen to be there, it would be a group of people doing something for the people that they think they're helping. But actually, you're all sat there earning a wage on the back of other women, of women that you are helping. And I can't see, but I'm doing rabbit ears here.
Yeah, she's doing rabbit. But also that thing, like in a technological age, we have opportunities to creatively include people without outing them. Exactly. And I think that we need to investigate those modalities, investigate those opportunities to do that, because we can hear from people in ways that are safe for them. Mm. And there's no excuse not to.
Exactly. So final question. What's next for you?
Oh God. Well, there, you know, wow. Sleep. There's a couple of things in the cooker. Dead. Say again.
We'll sleep when we're dead.
You're supposed to sleep now. I watched this TED talk about sleep and how we're shortening our lives if we don't. But yes, what's next for me right now is to pivot and focus on NUM. So I have to focus on making sure that NUM has the resources that it needs to operate, because we're doing very important work around providing support to individuals who are harmed from industry. So we are short of the mark in terms of diversity, in terms of reaching into communities who are more marginalized. And so, you know, we have a lot to do to have the N, capital N, national, as pronounced as it should be in NUM. We're missing people in terms of the digital divide. There are people who are still suffering from COVID and the impacts of COVID. COVID's not over for these populations and the impact is long, long lasting. So I'm going to focus in on and working with people who are investing in the safety agenda that we have around sex workers to build NUM to what it should be, because, you know, there's a lot of need for the organization, and I think that we're doing okay, but we're missing the mark in terms of really being of value to a large contingent of the population in sex industry. So I want to make sure that we're accountable and valuable to populations, and then all of the advocacy that has to come around that to prevent harm and to, you know, educate and to influence policy, and all of that needs to happen. So I want to focus on that. But I'm open to opportunities for research as always, but not for research's sake. I think that if sex workers were interested in exploring duality a bit more, I would be game for that. But I definitely want to participate in research that's driven by the population from the priorities that they are identifying. So a little sleep and a lot more work is next.
Anyone listening, NUM is the National Ugly Mugs, which is, you know, the foundation which Raven is the CEO of. So Raven, this is the chance for like shameless self promotion and plugging of said book. What's the book called? Who's publishing it? And who are you?
Excellent. The book is called Work, Money and Duality, Trading Sex as a Side Hustle, published by Policy Press. And my name is Dr. Raven Bowen.
And my name is Rachel Stewart. I'm a PhD researcher at the University of Kent, and this is the New Book Network, the Sex, Work and Sexualities channel. Thank you very much.